of this relationship, which may become fragile in the event of failure to reach a solution that satisfies all parties without least possible losses. This matter was evident in the joint press conference held by the foreign ministers of the two countries after the end of their talks in Riyadh. The two sides affirmed that the talks were positive and fruitful, and that they are witnessing progress and are moving in the right direction. Saudi Foreign Minister Faisal bin Farhan called for activating previously signed agreements between the two countries, especially in the fields of economy and security. Bin Farhan also indicated that Saudi Arabia sent an official invitation from Saudi King Salman bin Abdulaziz to Iranian President Ibrahim Raisi to visit Saudi Arabia, a visit that the Iranian foreign minister said would take place at the appropriate time. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian arrived in Saudi Arabia on August 17 on his first visit to the kingdom since the historic reconciliation between the two countries earlier this year. During a joint press conference following the talks, Saudi Foreign Minister Faisal bin Farhan stressed the importance of enhancing the scope of cooperation with the Islamic Republic and continuing consultations during the upcoming stage. To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Mr. Ali Murad, political commentator, researcher, and journalist at Al Akhbar Lebanese Daily. Thanks a million for being with us, Mr. Ali. Now, it was the first time that a high-ranking Iranian official has met with the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. And we also did hear Saudi Foreign Minister Faisal bin Farhan hailing the beginning of what he called a new phase with the Islamic Republic of Iran. Now, a lot has been said so far in the media about this new phase. However, is it truly a new phase of diplomatic and possibly economic relations, or rather are they stalling maybe for the upcoming elections in the U.S.?
There is no doubt that what is happening right now between the Islamic Republic of Iran and the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia is in politics somewhat different from the previous period. Are we in front of a new stage? Are the Saudis only buying time? In my opinion, the situation has changed now, and there are changes not only in the region, but also on a global level. A new world order is taking shape, and in my opinion, there is a conviction among the Saudi leadership that they cannot continue in the same direction in the policy that they were pursuing in the region. Therefore, in my opinion, Saudi Arabia is seeking to diversify its options and to reconcile with the region and with its neighbors, because it is indispensable for exposure to more damage due to the previous position, which was always under the American wing. This does not mean that the Saudi leadership is about to turn its back on the Americans, but rather they are about to move to a stage in which they deal with the Americans piece by piece. That is, when there is an interest for Saudi Arabia, they will stand with the United States, and when there is no interest, they will not stand by it. We saw this in the matter of energy. We are seeing it now at the time when the United States is displaying its strength in the region and increasing military reinforcements. All the while, Riyadh is receiving the Iranian foreign minister and announcing the upcoming visit of President Ibrahim Raisi to Riyadh. This is a clear message to the Americans from Saudi Arabia that they are committed to what they agreed upon with the Iranians in the Beijing Agreement on the 10th of last March.
Well, Mr. Ali, we also heard the Iranian foreign minister, Mr. Amir Abdullahian, talking about his visit to Saudi Arabia, saying that when he met with his Saudi counterpart, the talks between them, including the Palestinian cause, without specifically touching about which point they were discussing, to be exact. But in your views, what is the main topic about Palestine that Iran would want to discuss with Saudi Arabia?
Since the announcement of the signing of the Beijing Agreement, we have seen that there is a distinct Saudi stance towards the Palestinian cause, in the sense of everything that was before the agreement and was seen in the Saudi media coverage and the official Saudi positions towards the Palestinian issue, indicates a change of some kind in the firmness of their positions. Today we see positions issued by the Saudi Ministry of Foreign Affairs condemning the Israeli attacks in the West Bank, the aggression against Jenin, and even the recent aggression in Gaza. There are also positions reaffirming that Saudi Arabia will not make a normalization agreement or a peace agreement, in brackets, with the Israeli entity without there being recognition of a Palestinian state, in the sense that they will still consider themselves tied to the so-called Arab Peace Initiative. According to the information that I know, Mr. Faisal bin Farhan, the Saudi foreign minister, when he visited Tehran last June, he told his Iranian counterpart, "We want to reassure you and we will not proceed to normalization in a way that would be at the expense of the Palestinian people. And we are not in a hurry now to complete this matter." He indicated that this issue is left on the sideline, in the sense that it is not on their agenda for the things they intend to do now. The uproar we are hearing about the issue of Saudi-Israeli normalization currently, in my opinion, is prompted by the Americans for an American need. Today, the Biden administration wants to accomplish something before entering elections year, and it sees in its interest that there be an official agreement between Riyadh and Tel Aviv in order to confront the axis of resistance and also in order to prevent the Chinese rush and expansion into the region. Therefore, since Washington proceeds from its own interests, I believe there will be no acceptance from the other side, also due to the existence of an extremist government within the Israeli occupation entity that will not accept any rights to be given to the Palestinians or a state with recognized borders in the West Bank. Therefore, the Saudis see in a realistic way that the conditions are not yet ripe for signing any agreement with the occupying entity. There is no doubt that we need time to know what was said during the meeting between Mr. Abdullahian and Mohammed bin Salman. But in connection with what was previously said in Tehran during the visit of the Saudi foreign minister last June, we can conclude the foregoing information.
Well, many also referred to this new phase as a representative of legitimate Saudi policy shift. And we're talking a shift away from the U.S. here and the kingdom's intention to distance itself somehow from Washington and the West in favor of what they say regional prosperity and positive ties with its neighboring states like the Islamic Republic of Iran. However, Saudi Arabia is now back on the path of, let's say, a renewed U.S. Sponsorship push for the normalization that you were just talking about with the Israeli entity. In the event that happens, what would happen to the Saudi-Iranian rapprochement?
We can say that the Saudi behavior is being tested. In other words, from the Iranian side, the intentions have always been clear, and Iran's hand has always been extended to its neighbors in the Persian Gulf in order for an agreement to be reached to take care of the security of the region and prevent foreign interference. Now, when we ask what will be the future of this agreement between Saudi Arabia and Iran, we have to watch Washington's behavior. The clear behavior so far since the announcement of the Beijing agreement until today suggests that there is a carrot that Washington is trying to throw on all the Persian Gulf states, particularly Saudi Arabia, in the sense of enticement. That is, they are sending troops and reinforcements to tell the countries of the region that the United States is ready to renew its commitment to protect you, and that the Americans promised these countries with outputs such as railways linking the United Arab Emirates with Saudi Arabia, Jordan, and the occupying entity, and they promised a trade line. All these incentives that Washington puts on the table aim to empty the Beijing agreement of its meaning. Yes, the United States wants a de-escalation in the region, but it did not expect that de-escalation would mean a Saudi-Iranian agreement that would lead to a new regional order in which China would be present. This is what Washington does not want to see in the region. Therefore, we cannot underestimate all the pressures and inducements offered by Washington to influence the Saudi decision. But all of this must be set against a reality resulting from the formation of a new world order. Today, the leaders of the BRICS group are meeting in South Africa to discuss requests for accession of new countries. A group of countries has become influential in the way of forming a new global system, and the Saudi leadership views that Saudi Arabia is qualified to be a member of the club of these countries, including Turkey, India, South Africa, Brazil, and many regional countries that have emerging economies that can influence the formation of the global system. Therefore, we say that America's capabilities here are declining in their success by putting pressure on these countries and pushing them to return to the American camp.
Well, then we will have to wait and see how this meeting will come out, what will happen, what the results of this meeting will be, and we will also have to keep an eye on the electoral year in the United States of America. I want to thank you very much, Mr. Ali Murad, political commentator, researcher, and journalist at Al Akhbar Daily, for joining us. Thank you very much for your contribution. Now, ladies and gents, please stay tuned, because next we will talk about the terrorist attack on Shiraz in Iran.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marwa Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
A holy shrine in Iran's southern city of Shiraz has come under a second deadly attack in less than a year, with another terrorist gunman breaking into its grounds and opening fire. Last week, spokesman of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, Brigadier General Ramadan Sharif, announced that a number of foreign intelligence agencies were actually behind the Shah Cheragh attack. According to the latest news, the arrested terrorist is a citizen of one of Iran's neighboring countries. More details in this following report.
In a terrorist attack, the second of its kind in less than a year, the shrine of Sayyid Ahmad bin Musa al-Qadim, peace be upon them both, in Shah Cheragh, in the city of Shiraz, in the center of Fars province, southern Iran, was subjected to a terrorist attack on Sunday, August 13, during which seven people were shot. Iranian authorities have arrested 10 suspects in connection to the attack, in which terrorist gunmen killed one worshipper and injured six others. Chief Justice of Fars Province, Qasim Musawi, announced that the main gunman, who started shooting at people in the shrine and was immediately arrested, has been handed over to investigators for interrogation and further investigation. The terrorist who was arrested at the scene was carrying an assault rifle and eight magazines with 240 bullets, 11 of which he managed to get off before being subdued. Daesh, which has enjoyed support from Western and some Arab intelligence agencies, claimed credit for the attack. Daesh also claimed credit for an attack on worshippers at the Shah Cheragh Shrine in October 2022, which killed 15 people. At the time, IRNA reported that the gunman was a citizen of Tajikistan who died after sustaining injuries during his arrest. A month later, Iranian authorities says 26 men, which they described as Takfiri terrorists from Afghanistan, Azerbaijan, and Tajikistan, had been arrested in connection with the attack. On July 8, two other men of unspecified nationality were hanged in connection with the October shooting, and three other defendants were sentenced to prison for 5, 15, and 25 years. The group was also responsible for the coordinated 2017 attacks on the Iranian parliament and the mausoleum of former Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini in Tehran. Pictures from Tasnim showed bullet holes in what appeared to be barred windows at the entrance to the shrine, which is one of Iran's most important pilgrimage sites. The mausoleum includes the shrines of two sons of the 7th Shia Imam Musa al-Qadim, who are also the brothers of the 8th Imam Ali Rida, peace be upon them. The day after the terrorist attack, spokesman of the Islamic Revolutionary Guards Corps, Brigadier General Ramadan Sharif, said that a number of foreign intelligence agencies are behind the Shah Cheragh attack. while the Iranian Minister of Security, Ismail Khatib, confirmed that the attack on the shrine of Shah Cheragh was planned in one of the countries in the region, stressing that coordination was made with the authorities of this country to visit it and discuss the operation with them.
Now, to discuss this issue with us from Tehran is Ms. Sitare Sadiqi, political commentator and co-host of Twice Told Tales podcast. Thanks a million, Ms. Sitare, for being with us, and condolences to all of the Iranian people for the loss of their loved ones in this terrorist attacks. Now, the Iranian Tasnim news agency reported that the Tajik terrorist Rahmatullah Norozaf, the perpetrator of the terrorist attack in the shrine of Ahmad bin Musa in Shiraz, was associated with one of the leaders of Daesh, ISIS, via the internet. Then he went to Turkey for operational cooperation with the group Daesh, and then practically came he became an official member in it before coming back and actually performing this act of terrorism. How is Iran dealing with this new wave of terrorist threat that is being initiated from neighboring, supposedly friendly nations or countries?
Thank you for having me, and thank you for your condolence message. Well, as you know, and this second attack on the same shrine in Shiraz was reportedly plotted as a revenge for the execution and arrest of the perpetrators of the previous attack. So, as you can see, Iran has been seriously pursuing, identifying, and tracking these terrorists and punishing them with capital punishment, and trying to find the masterminds behind it. So I think Iran will continue to do the same thing, and Iran is going to try to identify the masterminds and the teams that are working with these foreigners that have been influenced by Wahhabi Takfiri terrorism mentality and ideology. As you know, Iran has always been a leading force against terrorism and in fighting terrorism. It was usually outside its borders, but because foreign agencies, and as you said, like there are intelligence agencies of the US and UK and other countries behind this, and they have been working very hard to create instability and insecurity inside the country so that they can create more chaos, and they have always been funding and arming and sponsoring different terrorist groups, including the MEK, including elements of Al-Qaeda, including elements of ISIS, and they want to create an instability everywhere in the region, including Iran.
Well, Sitare, the mastermind behind the terrorist Shah Cheragh attack, they had multiple goals in mind, most important of which is religious and ethnic differences and discrimination between neighboring countries, between them and Iran. This just straightforward puts a number of foreign intelligence agencies on the spot as beneficiaries of such attacks on Iranian religious sites. Is that having its toll with the Iranian communities? Meaning, is it actually achieving what it's supposed to achieve?
Well, yeah, that's what you can see that they have been pursuing. I mean, it has always been the goal of the imperialist powers, especially the British government and also the U.S., to create discord and sow discord among different religious denominations and ethnic groups so that they can rule over and control and manipulate this nation. But because the victims of terrorism, including ISIS, including Wahhabism, have not been from one particular religious denomination, and they have been from the Sunnis and Shias and Christians and even other groups of very different ethnic groups and religious groups. People here understand that this is not really about sectarian violence. It's not sectarian. It's an act of terrorism with victims that can come from any religious or ethnic backgrounds. For example, this particular shrine sounds to be a Shia shrine, and I mean it's known as a Shia shrine, but you could see there are images of Sunni Muslims praying inside the same shrine. So it was respected by Muslims of many different religious backgrounds. So they are trying very hard. That's what the propaganda is aimed at. But I would say because Iranian people have seen how terrorists have taken their tolls from many different religious denominations and ethnic groups, they do understand that this is not really about sectarian differences. And in that regard, I would say the propaganda has not been very successful. Of course, propaganda always manages to influence a minority, at least. And but this is not what you would see in the society or in the discussion among ordinary people on the streets or when you go to work or anywhere. People are not talking about the act of terrorism as something that has to do with sectarian differences.
Mm-hmm. Well, it is clear that the enemies of the Islamic Republic of Iran have drawn up a multi-layered project to make Iran insecure while also suffocating the people of Iran with the illegal punitive measures known to the world as sanctions. For sure, the Islamic Republic has a strategy to maybe deal with these attacks. However, what if this multi-layered project takes the form of internal unrest again, the likes of what happened last year in 2022? How will the Iranian people themselves deal with such a meddling?
You know, Iranians have a history of how foreign meddling into their countries has always been detrimental, has always been very hostile, and has been an attempt to suppress democracy, to suppress the public's will and public's or Iranians' interests. It started with the 1953 coup against the government of Mossadegh, which was perpetrated by the CIA and MI6 and toppled the government that was elected by the people or that was supported by the people. But it did not end there. And ever since the revolution, this meddling has accelerated. And as you said, and these sanctions, the crippling sanctions, are a very clear sign of how U.S. and European countries meddling into the country, into Iran's affairs, have been just suffocating Iranians, making ordinary life, or at least that's what they are trying to do. Because despite all these pressures, despite all these sanctions, and despite the like threats of terrorism and insecurity, Iranians are flourishing. Yes, they have grievances. Yes, they have different problems like any other country, but they're still continuing and supporting their establishments and supporting the democracy that they have. So there is this concern that all these insecurities and the security threats that are happening are aimed at creating paving the ground for another round of riots inside Iran and, you know, chaos and unrest. But people, I mean, even those who fell for the propaganda last year have seen how these so-called opposition groups outside, the so-called opposition coalition or whatever they called it, has already collapsed, and they are exposing themselves, like the members of those coalitions are exposing themselves. They have seen how they stole money from Iranian expats as well as from Iranian frozen assets held by the U.S. They stole that money, and the only thing that happened was that their bank accounts got fatter, mm-hmm. and they, their mansions got bigger.
We got the point of what is happening and how the Iranian people will actually stand in the face and against this propagated unrest by the Western world, especially the U.S. and its NATO allies. I want to thank you very much, Satera Siddiqui, political commentator and co-host of Twice Told Tales podcast. I want to thank you very much for your contribution, my dear Iranian friend, and I want to thank you, everyone, for your loyalty to our show and to our channel. Thank you for always being there, listening to what we have to say, because we are the voice of the voiceless for you, especially in the West, to hear. See you again next week on the Mid East Stream. Assalamu alaikum.
A diverse range of programs. Youth. Spirituality. Culture. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
An admission by the former White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows could complicate Donald Trump's defense in his classified documents case. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. National broadcaster ABC News has covered this story. Appearing to contradict former President Donald Trump's primary public defense in the classified documents case, former White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows had told special counsel Jack Smith investigators that he could not recall Donald Trump ever ordering or even discussing declassifying broad sets of classified materials before leaving the White House. Nor was he aware of any standing order from Donald Trump authorizing the automatic declassification of materials taken out of the Oval Office. Sources familiar with the matter have told ABC News. Ever since the FBI's seizure of more than 100 classified documents from his Mar-a-Lago estate last August, Donald Trump has insisted that he declassified all the materials before he left office. The former president now faces 40 separate criminal charges relating to his possession of those documents, ranging from unlawful retention of national defense information to various obstruction-related offenses. Donald Trump has pleaded not guilty to all charges and has denied any wrongdoing. ABC News has also reviewed an early draft of the prologue to Mark Meadows' book, The Chief's Chief, about his time serving as Trump's chief of staff for the final months of the Trump White House, which includes a description of Trump having a declassified war plan on the couch at his office in Bedminster, New Jersey, at a meeting attended by Mark Meadows' ghostwriter and publicist, but not by Mark Meadows himself. The reference to that document being in Trump's possession was removed before the book was published. Multiple sources have told ABC News that Mark Meadows acknowledged to investigators that he asked that the paragraph be changed and that it would be problematic had Donald Trump had such a document in his possession. Sources tell ABC News that Mark Meadows told special counsel investigators that they did not discuss making those edits with Donald Trump. Mark Meadows also told investigators that he was not involved in packing the boxes that Donald Trump took to Mar-a-Lago after leaving the White House. Mark Meadows has largely distanced himself from the removal of government documents from the White House, including classified materials. The sources said Mark Meadows told investigators he did not witness Donald Trump himself packing boxes and was unaware that Donald Trump had taken any government records, including classified documents. The former White House Chief of Staff also told investigators that shortly after the National Archive first requested the return of the official documents taken to Mar-a-Lago in 2021, he offered to Trump that he would go through the former president's boxes to retrieve the official records and send them back to Washington. Mark Meadows told investigators that Trump did not accept his offer, according to sources. Following the FBI's search of Mar-a-Lago in August of 2022, Donald Trump's team issued a statement to one media outlet claiming that, while still in office, Trump had issued a standing order that documents removed from the Oval Office and taken to his residence at Mar-a-Lago were deemed to be declassified the moment he removed them from the White House. On social media, Trump himself insisted that the documents at Mar-a-Lago were all declassified. According to sources familiar with the matter, Mark Meadows told investigators that he had heard the term standing order used during his time in the White House, but not in relation to the declassification process. While Trump's attorneys have not formally put forward such a defense in court, if they were to seek to make such a claim at trial, then prosecutors could see substantial value in putting forward Mark Meadows as a witness to counter such claims. In a statement to ABC News, a Trump spokesperson without evidence accused the Justice Department of selectively leaking incomplete information to impact the 2024 presidential election. The statement claimed the Department of Justice and the special counsel have resorted to selectively leaking incomplete information that lacks proper context because they know they can't win inside a courtroom. So now they're trying to deceive Americans through the court of public opinion. They added, "This witch hunt is nothing more than a desperate attempt to interfere in the 2024 election as President Trump dominates the polls and is the only person who will take back the White House." Mark Meadows recalled to investigators only one instance in his time serving as Trump's chief of staff where he claimed to see Trump declassifying documents involving a binder with materials from the FBI's Crossfire Hurricane investigation into Donald Trump's 2016 campaign's lies with Russia. Multiple sources familiar with the matter have confirmed. That order in the final days of Trump's time in the White House has been a subject of dispute, however, as the Justice Department has resisted publicly releasing the purported documents at issue. The British newspaper The Guardian has also covered the same story and tells us more. The former White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows told investigators he had no knowledge of Donald Trump either talking about or declassifying confidential information. It was reported on Sunday, 20th of August, potentially skewering the former president's defense in his classified documents case. Mark Meadows' alleged admission to the special counsel Jack Smith, reported by ABC News, suggests that Donald Trump made no blanket declassification of secret papers later seized from his Mar-a-Lago resort by FBI agents, leading to 40 criminal counts against him. Donald Trump, who pleaded not guilty to all the charges, has insisted without proof that he gave automatic clearance to every government document he took to Florida at the conclusion of his administration in January of 2021. While his lawyers have not yet presented the defense in court, and doing so could open the possibility of Mark Meadows being called as a witness to contradict it. According to ABC News, Mark Meadows also told special counsel Jack Smith he was not involved in packing the boxes and did not witness Donald Trump or anybody else doing so, and claimed he was not aware the former president was taking anything with him. If true, it would be extraordinary that one of Donald Trump's closest aides and chief of staff had absolutely no knowledge of anything to do with the retention of the documents. It might also suggest that Donald Trump knew what he was talking and planned and executed the operation himself. Trump's former Vice President Mike Pence also said he was unaware of any standing order for declassifying documents. Asked about the report, he told ABC's This Week program, "There is a process that the White House goes through to declassify materials. I'm aware of that occurring on several occasions over the course of our 4 years in office, but I don't have any knowledge of any broad-based directive from the president." Mike Pence, now challenging his former boss for the Republican presidential nomination, added, "That doesn't mean it didn't occur. It's just not something that I ever heard about." Asked if Mark Meadows, as Trump's chief of staff, should have been aware of any such broad declassification order from Donald Trump, Mike Pence said, "I would expect so." Meadows, who has remained publicly silent about the documents case, was indicted along with Donald Trump and 17 other individuals last week by Fannie Willis, the district attorney for Fulton County, Georgia, who is investigating efforts to reverse Joe Biden's election win in Georgia in 2020.
All we say to America is be true to what you said on paper.
We won't back down.
Stop the witch hunt.
Turn here now.
We will resist.
I can't breathe. Help me. Please.
We the people.
U.S. President Donald Trump has been indicted for the fourth time, and the fifth will probably follow soon. U.S. President Donald Trump has been indicted for the fourth time. He was indicted on four counts by Special Counsel Jack Smith, who has also obtained a search warrant for Trump's Twitter account. His second indictment was on federal charges in relation to his handling of classified information while out of office. He was first indicted earlier in the year by a Manhattan grand jury. Now that the fourth indictment has gone through, he will have to appear in four different courts, facing four different judges, defending against multiple allegations. Indictment series. The indictments against former U.S. President Donald Trump has not hurt his status as the fourth-running Republican candidate for the 2024 presidential election. In fact, it may have even helped him. Even with criminal charges, he has seen rising GOP primary poll numbers. Polls show a boost in support with each indictment faced by Trump. Several weeks before the first indictment in March, Trump had 43% of the vote in Republican polling. After he was indicted by a grand jury in Manhattan, his numbers jumped to 50%. When he was indicted again 2 months later for mishandling of classified documents, his polling average went to 55%. Public opinion went up each time, as well as his fundraising numbers. Funds have increased to cover Trump's legal funds.
And it is an outrageous criminalization of political speech. They're trying to make it illegal to question the results of an election.
Donald Trump has called the indictments poll boosting and said he considers each as a truly great badge of honor. On the impact of these charges, he said it is not going to make any impact because every time they file an indictment, we go way up in the polls. He then said that we need one more indictment to close out the election. One more indictment, and this election is closed out. Nobody has even a chance. What are the indictments against Donald Trump?
There are basically three indictments. They're very complicated, as you might expect, because they mix politics with criminal justice. The first of the indictments has to do with falsifying business records related to sex scandals in New York City. This is the so-called Stormy Daniels case. This is not unusual in politics to try to make someone look bad by implicating their personal life. This was what was done with Bill Clinton, for example, when he was impeached. The second indictment has to do with mishandling of classified documents. This is at the Mar-a-Lago estate in Florida. Trump is accused of hiding documents, mishandling them, treating them improperly. This is actually rather similar to charges that were made against Joe Biden and Hillary Clinton, but this is being handled quite differently because Joe Biden is in power. The third indictment, which in a certain sense is the most sensational, is a federal indictment, which is a conspiracy indictment. Conspiracy indictments are often used when they can't find any actual evidence of a crime, but they suggest that the person was somehow involved in thinking about or talking to others about committing a crime. It's a way of getting people that you can't get in a normal way. And this is having to do with efforts to overturn the 2020 election. I think that this is related to the riots that took place on January the 6th.
Special Counsel Jack Smith is investigating Trump on behalf of the U.S. Department of Justice on his actions during the 2020 elections and the January 6th attack on Congress. He applied for a search warrant for the @RealDonaldTrump account on Twitter and was granted the request, citing probable cause. The court also granted a non-disclosure order with the warrant, so Twitter would not notify Trump or his allies about the search.
I'm not one of the people who pretend like Trump was the only innocent president. He was the president of a superpower. You know, he's a former billionaire. He is one of the elites, and I think that people should not mistake that. However, he is one of the elites that is deemed to be unpredictable by the current establishment, Democrat or Republican for that matter. But he's the front runner still for the Republican nomination. He is polling higher now than before, actually. He's polling more. He's polling better than Joe Biden at the moment, despite the fact that he's been indicted multiple times. Biden can't talk his way out of a trash bag at the moment, okay? He doesn't know. He looks like he's one of the kind of guys who needs help going to the bathroom and finding his way back to the podium. He quite literally can't find his way off the stage half the time. And yet they don't really have a formidable candidate on the Democratic side to beat Trump if these indictments don't turn in anything. And they really don't have any ammo to beat Trump if he walks off scot-free entirely.
Twitter, which has recently rebranded to X, was held in contempt by a federal court and fined $35,000 for delaying compliance with the search warrant of Trump's Twitter account. Trump was a frequent user of Twitter before and during his presidency with more than 88 million followers. He was banned from the social media platform after the January 6th Capitol riots for inciting violence.
Meanwhile, Mr. Trump continues to rage against the special counsel who, we learned yesterday, executed a warrant to seize Mr. Trump's Twitter data earlier this year. Unsealed court documents revealed that Twitter, now rebranded as X, delayed in complying with handing over that data over a provision in the warrant that prevented the company from telling Mr. Trump about it at all. Now, the company was fined $350,000 as a result of that delay. Mr. Trump called that episode an attack on his Twitter and a hit on his civil rights. No word yet on what evidence Smith was able to pull from the former president's account, which you'll remember has been dormant since he was banned from the platform after January 6th. Savannah.
Trump later developed his own platform, Truth Social, where he posts his ideas and comments. When Elon Musk took over Twitter, he reinstated Trump's account in November 2022. Even though social media like Twitter boast of being pioneers of free speech, they even censored their own president. Social media like Twitter regularly incite violence in other countries, especially U.S. foes, but censor those that might cause turmoil in the United States.
Which I find interesting is the fact that Elon Musk and Twitter were fined $350,000 because the DOJ requested the Twitter information, the Twitter account information from Donald Trump. And Twitter actually tried to fight this in court legally, claiming that it violated Trump's free speech. And they didn't give a reason as to why they wanted the information. They just said it was important to a case. And then they actually sent an NDA attached to that subpoena from the DOJ so that Trump couldn't even know that his account information was being requested. Whenever Twitter tried to appeal it, they were actually held in contempt of court. They were fined $50,000 on the first day that they did not produce the information. And then every single day after that, it doubled.
Prosecutors are trying to silence Trump, asking the judge to order him to keep the evidence turned over to him by the prosecution away from public eyes and ears. Trump has said he doesn't care and accused U.S. President Joe Biden of weaponizing the Justice Department against him. He announced to a crowd of supporters that they don't want me to speak about a rigged election. They don't want me to speak about it, whereas I have freedom of speech, First Amendment.
There it appears to the naive viewer in the United States that there is a huge and very bitter struggle between the Democratic Party and the Republican Party. But in reality, this is a distraction, because behind the scenes, the two parties agree on the most important policies, which are, in my view, the policy of neoconservatism, the desire to dominate the world using primarily military force. Neoconservatives are people who strongly admire the British Empire and who take foreign policy direction from the British, and they have come to dominate both parties, which is why the United States has the largest military in world history, and there is no resistance to this coming from either party. And military adventures such as the present proxy war against Russia and Ukraine are warmly endorsed by both parties. Both parties also support an economic policy of supporting financial speculation over manufacturing and farming and useful physical production, which is what is ruining the United States economy. But both parties have gone along with it every step in the way. So all of the bitter fighting that you see at election time is essentially theater.
U.S. District Judge Tanya Chutkan said Trump's right to free speech in the January 6th case is not absolute. After hearing with Trump lawyers and special counsel Jack Smith and his team, the judge issued a protective order barring Trump from public disclosing sensitive information in the case. She also warned Trump of intimidating witnesses or obstruction of justice, emphasizing that she will be scrutinizing Trump's public statements very carefully.
Prosecutors accusing Donald Trump of plotting to overturn the 2020 election had sought what's called a protective order in the case, barring the former president from publicly sharing evidence that could be used to threaten or intimidate government witnesses. But a federal judge on Friday said that the requested order was too broad. However, she warned Trump to tread carefully about making inflammatory public statements.
The case is a ridiculous case. It's a First Amendment case. But we don't want Trump to speak. So they want me, they take away your rights on First Amendment. Now,
at a speech in New Hampshire earlier this week, Trump railed against the requested order.
I will talk about it. I will. They're not taking away my First Amendment right.
The government's request for a protective order cited a threatening message Trump posted last week on social media. If you go after me, I'm coming after you.
The protective order came after Trump wrote on his platform, Truth Social, "If you go after me, I'm coming after you." Prosecutors cited this post and asked for a protective order that will limit what Trump can publicly say about the case. Later in New Hampshire, Trump vowed to continue to speak about legal issues, saying, "I'll talk about it. I will. They're not taking away my First Amendment right."
With each new indictment, his popularity in the polls goes up. So the people that were hoping to discredit him and sabotage his candidacy by these indictments, they're not getting what they want. They're not going to stop, though. They're going to escalate. At this point, we're getting new indictments just about every month. It's becoming almost routine. And the population of the United States is angry at the powers that be. They're angry at the so-called establishment, which is why they support candidates like Trump or Robert Kennedy Jr. or Bernie Sanders or Dr. Cornel West. They may not necessarily agree strongly with these candidates, but they like the fact that the establishment is bitterly opposed to them. And so every time the establishment does something against Trump, it's going to attract more of these kinds of voters to Trump's campaign.
Corruption is not new in U.S. politics or in different U.S. administrations and among presidents and vice presidents. However, with scandals and corruption becoming more in the open and partisan attacks against each other more vicious, the bankruptcy of the U.S. political system is becoming more and more evident. What will be the outcome of Trump's legal troubles?
I don't think much will come of it. I don't think that he'll actually get real legit jail time. I do believe that this will probably last for the entirety of the presidency, the presidential election. I think that this will last for the entirety of the presidential election. And we have an example already. This same type of situation happened when Donald Trump was impeached by the Democrats in the middle of an election. They had talked about impeaching him, just like they had talked about bringing charges against Trump in the past. And then the moment that the elections ramped up and Trump looked like he was polling extremely well, he was getting more popular, he was drawing those numbers that Bernie Sanders would draw, for example, on the left. That moment is whenever the impeachment went from possible to we're going to do our damnedest to see that he's entrenched in the drama of impeachment for the entirety of the election, so that now every time he's questioned about something, you have to spend half of his time discussing this. At that time, the impeachment. So we're going to see the same thing again with the indictments, in my opinion, that the indictments are supposed to distract him, distract the media, and give something else to talk about by the media regarding Trump.
Each political party attacks the FBI and judicial system when they go after their president or top candidate. Democrats were hammering the former FBI director James Comey over his role in investigating Hillary Clinton's email scandal, or the way they relentlessly attacked the FBI over the Monica Lewinsky disgrace. Now the Republicans are attacking the FBI director for probing into allegations against Donald Trump.
Well, Trump, like Robert Kennedy and other of what are called populist candidates, has opposed the establishment in many important ways. The most significant is opposing the proxy war in Ukraine. The establishment is very frightened that Americans will turn against it. In fact, opinion polls, I think conducted by CNN recently, indicated that the majority of Americans now oppose sending more money and weapons to Ukraine. It's clearly not working. The Ukrainian government is not going to win this war. And it's been fantastically expensive and also extremely dangerous because they're provoking Russia to the point of a possible nuclear war. And I don't think Americans really appreciate how dangerous that is, but they're generally getting pretty tired of the war. Trump speaking out against it is a problem for the people that want the war to continue and escalate.
This is not to say that the FBI or the Justice Department are actually probing for justice or the truth. The timing of these indictments against Donald Trump obviously indicates that the Department of Justice sat on evidence that it had obtained until Trump and other presidential campaigns were well underway and then charged him with several crimes. Experts believe whether Trump is found guilty or not, these legal battles will bug him down and make his campaign efforts difficult.
You haven't seen this type of animosity. You haven't seen this type of effort being put into shutting down like Ron DeSantis' campaign, for example, because they don't believe he's a threat. You don't see this. You don't. What we're seeing is Trump making light of a situation that the Democrats want to be serious, and I believe it's a campaign strategy. He's saying they don't have anything, and they know it. But I'm going to keep campaigning as if I am unbothered by what's taking place, because I am unbothered by what's taking place, because I understand that the reason that this is happening is because I am a threat to Joe Biden or whoever, you know, the Democratic nominee will be, because they have no actual strategy to beat Donald Trump, at least a real electoral strategy on the ground or messaging to beat Donald Trump. So instead, they're going to use all the powers that they have at their disposal, all the tools that they have at their disposal, in order to beat Donald Trump in a way that doesn't involve actually dealing with him in an election.
It is a daunting task for everyone, even without a running presidential campaign, to juggle four different criminal cases. With evidence coming in from the prosecutors, Trump needs to sit down with his lawyers to explain the evidence and decide how they will plan their defense strategy. This will take a great amount of time and energy, the time and energy he needs to run a successful campaign. What has been Trump's response regarding his prosecution and allegations?
Well, Trump is a political amateur and a very confused person. He's full of surprises. He will say something which appears to me to be highly intelligent, and then the next day he'll say something which appears to be, you know, childishly stupid. One thing that I think is worth mentioning is the way that this is being viewed by world leaders in other countries. When Trump was indicted back at the beginning, I think in March, there were statements issued by the presidents of Mexico and the president of El Salvador. Neither of them are friendly to Trump politically. Both of them would be considered leftist. But President Andrés Manuel López Obrador of Mexico, I'll read you a quote from him. He said that if Trump were indicted, it would be so that his name doesn't appear on the ballot. I say this because I, too, have suffered from the fabrication of a crime when they didn't want me to run. And this is completely anti-democratic. Why not allow the people to decide?
And when the trial actually starts, depending on the number of witnesses and evidence being presented, it could become lengthy. It would probably be expected from Trump to be present in at least some of the trial proceedings. Even if the judge would not require him to be present, it is not a good idea to skip trial, since it would send a negative signal to the jury, stating that the defendant thinks the court is a waste of time and they should be somewhere else more important.
You know, the population is very dissatisfied with the candidates that are being offered. There was a recent poll conducted just at the end of July by Yahoo News indicating that the majority of Americans believe that both Trump and Biden are unfit for office. I find that to be very credible. I think people are very unhappy with the political leadership that we've had over the past several decades. The American economy is a shambles. Our foreign policy has made us feared and despised by the rest of the world. So whatever happens with Trump will tend just to accelerate this kind of process. Again, Trump doesn't really offer positive leadership. The only thing he has to offer is he's against the establishment, they're against him, and that makes him attractive to many voters.
In order for the Justice Department to deflect some of the criticism of being politically biased against Trump, Attorney General Merrick Garland has appointed David Weiss to be special counsel in probing Hunter Biden. It seems that legal proceedings would at least shape a large part of the 2024 presidential elections. Hunter Biden had come to a sweet deal with the prosecution over his tax evasion and gun charge. However, it collapsed with a Trump-appointed judge's decision, citing multiple concerns over the specifics of the deal.
The DOJ, for all intents and purposes, is ran by the president. It is an executive branch. And that is being weaponized against the president in situations that we have never seen before. This is the first time that a president has ever been indicted. Obviously, he hasn't actually been prosecuted, but this is the first time ever that a president has actually been indicted. On the other side of that fence, we have the Hunter Biden hearings, IRS whistleblower hearings, evidence upon evidence upon evidence showing that there's been some quid pro quo behavior amongst the Bidens and that Joe Biden himself was involved. This same DOJ that works for Biden that is coming up with every measure possible to harass Donald Trump during an election season is pretending as if Joe Biden and Hunter Biden are not guilty of at least some crime by effectively not doing any significant investigation. And in some cases, according to the whistleblower hearing, impeding investigations. One of the counts, by the way, one of the felony counts that they accused Donald Trump of doing, impeding investigations. So when you see an obstruction of justice by the DOJ, to protect the Biden family, while simultaneously you see an abuse of justice by the DOJ that works for the Biden family constantly being used against the opponent of Joe Biden, that's a problem.
Most U.S. politicians have always put their own interests above the people and their country. With political fighting on the rise, fears of an actual civil war and secession looms over the whole country. People are extremely divided. They are either for or against Donald Trump. Vicious fighting among people on social media reveals the huge divide that has occurred among ordinary Americans as well as the elites.